Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and this is Sara Gone Rogue, dealing with everything that is politics. And I have to say that listening to that song in Yiddish, I've never heard a Yiddish pop song. It was very jolly, and I wondered whether my Yiddish-speaking grandmother would have been disapproving or approving of it. But more power to the singer's elbow. I gather he's very trendy looking as well, so nothing wrong with that. But, you know, just to hark back to training grenades going through AXA contracted security, I imagine that it's going to get fairly nasty between AXA and its contractor. But it raises the point of why are we even doing this? It also segues to South African Airways, and it reported a loss of 350 million rand last year. Now, it had followed a profit of over 200 million rand the previous year, 2023. SAA has said that the problem was the increased cost of fuel and aircraft leases. But it's clearly there's been some very questionable accounting and possibly auditing of SAA, because notwithstanding the fact that it is still virtually, it's still majority government owned, and I haven't heard that many people who've had much to say about SAA whatsoever, its sheer lack of profile, if nothing else, suggests that the mysterious profit, which one would argue it shouldn't really be attracting if it isn't entirely self-funding as the other airlines which are private do. It seemed a bit strange. Well, it wasn't strange. It was a mistake. So let's not be too surprised at that. Now, there's a great heading in saying Durban sewerage in the dock. Now, who would have thought that sewerage being in the dock would be a good thing? But it's in the dock in the sense that Durban municipal leaders are coming under renewed legal pressure to devise more ambitious and, shall we say, credible action plans to resolve a long-standing sewage management crisis. As we know, it's led to widespread pollution of rivers and the repeated closure of tourist beaches, which is a real disaster for a city like Durban, where tourism is and should be a major source of income. Now, this action was brought by the Democratic Alliance and Action South Africa more than 2 years ago, and there were separate actions. They're to be heard in a couple of days, but their parties have now joined into a single case to determine whether the city has responded reasonably to resolve the crisis. They've also got to consider new measures, an independent administrator, oh good heavens, who'd have thought, to supervise the city's wastewater management and plans for remediation. So while the city has largely blamed the crisis on the floods of April, May in 2022, and having had limited budgets for repair, but it's actually happened because of years of neglect and failure to maintain and upgrade infrastructure. And that sort of simple set of logic is what underlies South Africa, Johannesburg's water crises, the breaking of pipes, the damaging of roads, etc., etc. So, you know, at least it brings to light through a formal process such as the judiciary that ultimately there can be accountability for a failure to simply do a proper job of work.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Obviously, still dominating the news is the fact that the Minister of Police, Sindo Nkunu, has been put on leave, paid leave, while a commission of inquiry looks into allegations that basically surround crime. The commission of crime unexpectedly or surprisingly or whatever the right term would be, closing down a unit, a criminal investigation unit, trafficking of guns, etc., etc. It's been probably one of the biggest scandals, potential scandals that South Africa could face. Now, that in addition to, so that is ongoing, but as a result, we now have Nkunu on paid leave. We've got Gwede Mantashe as acting police chief for the next 10 days, say, until the 1st of August. When the new police chief comes in to essentially stand in, I think he will be the acting police chief, Feroz Kachale, who is retiring as a Wits Law professor. And because the retirement doesn't come into effect at the beginning, until the beginning of August, he will only take over in August. So we have Mantashe in the role. I kind of do wonder why we need someone to act for even for, you know, for a shorter period as a couple of weeks, as it really doesn't make any difference. I'm sure there's some policy or foundational reason for it, but it really it seems like a complete waste of, well, hopefully not a waste of money. Hopefully Gwede Mantashe is not receiving payment for the activity. I want to just go and highlight just how serious the issue of Nkabisi Jonas is as the rejected special envoy for South Africa as appointed by President Ramaphosa. And there's been a huge amount of news about this, the fact that Emma Powell of the DA, for the shadow minister for the portfolio of international relations and cooperation, raised the question as to what he had achieved in the past few months since his appointment. And it then came out that not only had he not done anything, but he probably hadn't gone anywhere because, and this is something that I think just has to be borne in mind about how dishonest our president can be and the ramifications that it holds. They have sought to vilify Ms. Powell and basically accuse her of activities that undermine or give a bad image to the state when everything she does was both above board and to some extent even approved of by approval was expressed by the president's spokesman. And we had the ugly scenario of a security services report into her behavior, and it really, the response has not covered anybody in glory from government, from the minister down to his representative in the media or for the media, as well as the spokesperson for the Department of International Relations itself. But just to highlight the culpability of this and the risk to businesses that our increasingly toxic relationship with America portends, and this will have had absolutely no benefit whatsoever. President Ramaphosa had been warned against sending Jonas as special envoy to the US. And Jonas himself specifically asked not to be included in the May delegation that ended up in the famous White House meeting. He himself had actually asked not to be included in the delegation, notwithstanding that he had valid documents to the US. Sir Ramaphosa could not possibly have been ignorant of MTN's group close ties to Iran. Jonas being the chairman of MTN currently, and and the claims of in a number of court cases, and particularly in New York, claims against MTN that they knew or recklessly disregarded the entities which did business supporting a terrorist campaign that lasted for over a decade. And the MTN apparently, including in this, allegedly provided those entities with funding, embargoed American technology and equipment and logistical and other logistical provisions and support. Now, the problem is that in a 2020 lecture, a public lecture, Mkhabisi Jonas insulted Trump. He called him a racist, a homophobe, and a narcissistic right winger. So Trump, Trump would never have accepted him from the get-go. And what I want to highlight is that what Emma Powell what was revealed when Emma Powell asked what donors had achieved in the past 90 days is that essentially what had happened is that the president was informed and knew before June that he had been rejected. He had not been accredited by the U.S. and his appointment by South Africa had been rejected by the Trump administration. And yet in June, Cyril Ramaphosa went public, I mean really, really public, to say that Jonas was still his special envoy. The tricksiness and the adherence to a narrative that was so shallow and so irrelevant and so easy to, for anyone, particularly someone in Emma Powell's position, to make a relevant issue out of is simply actually stunning. And in a way, for me, that little process of dishonesty that the president embarked upon says more about him and about the almost, I don't know if it's an intentional idea to really end up in a fight with the Americans, but given that the fact in that in a few days, really beginning 30% tariffs, probably plus more percent, will come into effect against South African business doing business in America, defies description. So the perpetuation of a lie, how on earth could they have thought they would get away with it?
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Well, very coincidental, coincidentally, President Ramaphosa yesterday sent out his weekly missive to the people under the heading Reforms Are Bearing Green Shoots. It's his letter from the desk of the president. And in it, he was talking about the significant progress in clearing obstacles with a view to enhancing economic growth. And that vehicle is Operation Vulindlela. And it details a government-wide initiative which is aimed at accelerating progress on economic reform. Now, I'm not sure if those green shoots are now sort of tall trees giving shade to all and sundry, but coincidentally, and probably sort of reading my mind, I have invited my colleague Chris Hutting, Executive Director of the Center for Risk Analysis, to come online and to tell us all about Operation Vulindlela, because we hear it often mentioned. Chris, welcome back to, well, now Saragon Rogue, but Chai FM.
Hi, Sarah. Good morning. Always good to get to talk to you and to the listeners. Yeah, we have incoming tariffs, and meanwhile we have a Ramaphosa administration focused on fighting with the DA more than actually implementing reform. So let's see what we can figure out.
Well, just on that, I see that he has got rid of, however he got rid of her, the Minister of Higher Education, who lied to Parliament about appointments to the boards of CETAs and the process that was followed. So the DA is obviously having some effect. Whether he will fire the second minister, they said he had to fire before they would approve her budget, we have yet to see. Chris, what is Operation Vulindlela? We've heard about it. The president refers to it quite often as, you know, achieving something for our infrastructure development and thereby our growth. What exactly is it?
Yeah, so ostensibly, so if we wanted to steelman the idea or the position, Operation Vulindlela, launched by President Ramaphosa during his first administration, when he first came in as president of the country, trying to identify bottlenecks in various areas of policy and in the economy, and then to focus government effort, be that through ministries, through the presidency, through state-owned entities and others, in collaboration with the private sector in the so-called work streams. So initially a few work streams were identified, mainly crime, electricity and logistics. They've now added quite a few more. So as is inevitable with government plans and initiatives, it becomes quite broad, as it were, in its focus. But that was ostensibly the focus, was to identify these bottlenecks and then to fix them or remove them in whatever way possible. So sort of collaboration between government and the private sector.
We hear very little about, certainly from the private sector itself, what has been achieved. And of course, the question that needs to be asked is, did the presidency and Treasury have to actually create any direct involvement at the cost to the taxpayer to get the ministries responsible for infrastructure upgrade and development actually going? I mean, isn't it really a case of demanding accountability from ministers with or without involvement by the private sector? That should have been, I would assume, should have been up to the individual ministries. Did we need the president to be involved on an ongoing basis directly?
Yeah, so I think some of the question was, in those ministries and in those departments, whether they had, number one, the sort of skills, and number two, the resources. So it's not to, I think your point around that the ministers themselves should have just been doing their work. Why add more? Why give them more of a burden by getting more people involved, as it were? But it's more maybe about the departments themselves. That was ostensibly the focus, where given the skills deficit in government, they simply couldn't tackle a lot of the sort of basic administrative and other problems that were faced. Number two, breaking up some of the vested interests, I think, would have been part of some of the initial hope, as it were. So if you bring in the private sector, if you bring in other non-state players, then there's possibly an opening for breaking up vested interests, more competition in problem solving and ideas, and just something different than what had come before. Mm-hmm. But of course, if you then bring those other people in and ministers still don't perform, or they still block reform, or they just give contracts to their pals and their families and all that kind of thing, then you're just adding more people to the sort of government payroll, as mm-hmm. it were, because some of those private sector individuals might have done it out of the goodness of their heart and not demanded compensation, but I'm sure very many others would have demanded something, whether it's access, sort of in-kind payment or direct remuneration. So you still add to the sort of general bloat and inefficiency of government in the best case scenario. And in the worst case scenario, by establishing some of these work streams, especially with big business and government, you give some more opening and incentive to sort of the worst kind of crony capitalism and the sort of crony state work that there can be, because they then have access to reform and they have access to the boardrooms where these policy potential reform decisions are made that benefit their companies in the long run.
Can you give us an idea of the particular work streams where the private sector has been considerably involved, and B, which have shown signs of progress and of contributing to the ultimate goal of economic growth?
So I think number one has to be electricity. And here you look at the skills that have been brought into the board of Eskom, but also to the power stations from a management point of view, where Eskom has stabilized some of its coal fleet operations. Mm. It's not to say that those issues have all been resolved, but if you look at the energy availability factor of Eskom, which was below 50% 2 years ago when we had our regular bouts of stage six and higher load shedding, that energy availability factor has now stabilized between sort of 55 and 60%. It is still helped by diesel, by using a lot of diesel for some of those operations. So it's not to say that the coal fleet has been completely sort of fixed, but I think there has been sort of stabilizing the ship at Eskom, and that's thanks to a lot of private sector work being involved, and even not in the work stream directly, but just how much the private sector has invested in solar panels. So that takes pressure off of Eskom. Number two, if we look at crime, and not crime broadly, because of course South Africa still has one of the highest murder rates in the world. When President Ramaphosa was in the White House, you know, the narrative is, no, there's no white genocide, there's just genocide
of crime.
Affects everyone. So it's not the best pro-investment message to be making on the global stage. But in any case, so crime, when you look at the sector of mining, and you look at the work done by a company like Sibanye-Stillwater, the outgoing CEO, Neil Froneman, the work he did in that particular work stream, he and some other businessmen, to get private sector expertise, to get equipment, to get skills involved in protecting mining operations, and also to start to help protecting equipment in on the railways, so in the logistics area. I want to be positive on the logistics side, but we just haven't seen the turnaround in throughput in the ports, and also sort of the volumes on railway networks. There is a new border Transnet, they've been there for a while now, but even though there's still continued talk of, yes, we want private sector investment and involvement, you just don't see it in number one, the policy document changes, or number two, actual investments in the harbors and on the railway. So I'd say at the moment, electricity and crime, maybe the main two. Maybe in a roundabout way, you can talk about the financial sector and the whole grey listing issue, where it looks like we might get taken off the grey list later this year. I wouldn't be too excited on that yet, because it's yet another tool that President Trump can use against South Africa, should he so choose to, regarding trade and other diplomatic matters, to still keep us, to apply pressure for us to be kept on the grey list.
Now, I know I think we both attended a talk about Transnet, where some indication was that progress was being made, and that the relatively new transport minister, Barbara Creasy, is a real force to be reckoned with, and things are happening. But one sense is, and possibly this applies to the whole issue of logistics, is that there are so many vested interests in, as banal as big, senior people not losing jobs, that there's a lot of opposition that even the government has to deal with, or recalcitrance that the government has to deal with, even if it has the best intentions and preparedness to cooperate with the private sector.
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. I mean, with Transnet, with logistics, with lots of other areas of the economy that the government is so involved in, quite a number of the people sort of in government are still driven, or mainly in the ANC, are still driven by ideological predilections. But I think more and more it's becoming a case of pure sort of survival and maintaining patronage networks and access to resources. If you've gotten your position or built up your position in the party and in government thanks to sort of kickbacks and favors, then someone has that over you, and you've also got that over the next person. That's, you know, how you continue to maintain your lifestyle, how you have access to power and influence. And I think that's still remaining the case. I mean, if you look at the logistics, how much road freight has taken from rail freight over the last 20 years to break up, to bring in more competition there, the vested interest in trucking would be quite an undertaking, I think, more so even than the ports. And then also there's the question of sort of provincial and metro responsibility. So, for example, if you said Durban or Cape Town or Richards Bay, those cities or those provinces then take charge of the port operations, that then for the sort of central government would be seen to undermine their, you know, what they think is their rightful place in managing the whole country's sort of logistics network. So again, the sort of combo of ideological and just vested interest blocks, as it were, or blockades.
Yes. Now, what Cyril Ramaphosa says in his weekly letter or missive is this report shows that the economic reform program is making steady progress, opening the way to more rapid, inclusive, and sustainable growth and job creation. Now, it's quite interesting because I think what that wording shows is that the program, i.e. Vulindlela, is making steady progress, which could mean very slow progress. I'm not sure about opening the way to rapid, more inclusive and sustainable growth. Inclusive and sustainable probably being amongst my pantheon of least favorite words. But if there is progress being made under Vulindlela, is it actually having any impact on growth in South Africa or any growth at all? I mean, the sense is that really we are really teetering above barely above a 0% growth rate. We just offer nothing to our people at this stage that would relieve the burden on unemployment, and we offer nothing to make investors attracted to us.
Yeah, I wish I could disagree with you and give you numbers that tell a different story, but it's just not there in the data. I mean, the economic growth rate, we are consistently below 1%. The fixed capital formation rate, which, you know, that's your investment in your roads, your bridges, your mining, your heavy plant equipment, all those things that are difficult to take out of a country. So if there's more investment in those kinds of things, it tells you that there's more domestic and international confidence in that country's prospects. South Africa has a target of 30% gross fixed capital formation as a percentage of GDP. The only time we ever got close to that was 21% in 2008-2009. Usually we get between sort of 13 and 15%. Other emerging markets can get between 20 and 25%. So from a policy point of view, from a sentiment and narrative point of view, there isn't that willingness to sink capital into South Africa. Now, you know, one can talk about sort of ideological policy issues, the high rate of crime, South Africa's foreign policy sort of signals and messaging. Generally, you know, take away the stuff around expropriation, NHI, whatever, just the conditions aren't conducive to capital forming in the country, and then in turn, pushing growth higher and creating more growth opportunities. You also then look at how some of our sectors perform, economic sectors that are crucial for employment, like mining, manufacturing. We at the CRA, our latest macro review report looked at the state of mining and manufacturing in the country. Mining, manufacturing output was lower in 2024 than it was in 2004. So if you just look at it from a pure output point of view, aside from the narrative from people like President Ramaphosa, businesses and investors don't yet see that the sentiment around the GNU translates into changes in reality. That isn't to say it can't and it won't, to change a sort of around, to move around what has been such a low growth normal for South Africa will take quite a lot of time. But you're not yet seeing in any sort of the indicators a sense that higher economic growth is just around the corner.
Are we not facing now the problem where really Cyril Ramaphosa is focused on dealing very much with his compadres? There's the whole issue. You get a sense of panic with conceding to getting rid of one of the ministers that the DA said he needed to get rid of to pass the departmental budget. That is quite stunning when you think about how doggedly they hang on to people who've been detrimental both to the ANC in effect and the country. Are the people who support him just expending way too much energy on keeping the ANC alive, and consequently they can't concentrate on all those things at once?
Yeah, we can say lots of things about President Ramaphosa, how long he takes to act, etc., etc. One thing he has always said and delivered upon, so to give him credit, you know, it's one thing he said and he actually did, is he wants to keep the party united. So it's party unity above any other considerations. Mm-hmm. And often that has, you know, that comes at the cost of, for example, holding people accountable, the cost of the country and society more broadly, potential for economic growth, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's the more that the party is declining in terms of electoral support, the more desperate I think it becomes inside to keep who's still involved happy, and then also to give them the sort of rewards that they demand to be part of it. It's just, I mean, you see it in the formation of cabinets, you see it in the formation of the NEC, of the new minister of higher education and the deputy minister, where there's also now a clear move to try and sort of help or assuage some concerns in KwaZulu-Natal, where you had the allegations by Commissioner Mkhwanazi against the now suspended or put on special leave former police minister. Mm. It's all these calculations the whole time. So I don't want to give President Ramaphosa a sort of get out of jail free card. It's the bed he's made for himself, because he hasn't held people accountable and acted against corrupt individuals. But now it's just a case of using whatever access you still have to keep people happy to whatever extent you can. I think for Ramaphosa, from a personal legacy point of view, for him, the worst thing would be to be recalled or a motion of no confidence. And that means he's going to be continuing to find whatever creative ways he can to keep as many people in the ANC happy, or at least not focused on him as possible.
And the new Minister of Higher Education, Phuthumani Mela, is a member of the South African Communist Party. So it's about keeping the tripartite alliance together as well, and keeping them happy. Chris Hutton, thank you very much for that foray into an operation we hear about, but I think very few of us know about. Thank you very much. Where can people find the CRA's work?
Anywhere on social media, so on X, on LinkedIn, on YouTube. We have quite an active YouTube channel where we discuss lots of things, and then also on the CRA website, www.cra.com, where you can find access to our reports, to our client subscription options. Get in touch with us anytime. We can assist with any data research work. So we're happy to tackle these sort of economic and political questions in South Africa.
Super. Chris, thank you.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
We know that the government has doubled down on the application of BEE, everything from the ill effects that are likely to be had in the mining sector, the fact that private sector now will have to reach extraordinary targets, which are actually quotas, which largely exclude really the entry into positions by white males. There's blowback against that. Court action is being taken against that. And yet it is clearly one of the things that America said, if South Africa did away with BEE, it would be a very much a positive factor in its regard for South Africa. But the president has insisted that we need BEE, it's necessary for reform, and that essentially the general tenor coming out from the ANC is that any attempts to criticize it means you're anti-reform and probably racist to boot. But what does BEE look like? Because one of the accusations leveled against the whole idea of BEE is that the idea is to benefit what effectively are small groups of people that are connected particularly to the ANC to, I don't know, grow their careers, get into positions they would certainly not otherwise have been got into, and more particularly would unlikely to be suitable to, essentially leapfrogging over the need for the skills in the sectors that they are designed to be headed towards. Well, there was an article in this past Sunday Times headed Young Lions Get Their Share, and this probably more than anything illustrates what the ANC means by BEE and why it is the antithesis of reform. It's just favoritism, nepotism, I don't know what you want to call it. What they say is that at least 8 ANC Youth League leaders, they call them, have been handed, quote, cushy posts on the boards of Gauteng's beleaguered public hospitals. One youth leader said that comrades were encouraged to apply and that the party would lobby for them to get the post. Now, the situation of hospitals, particularly in Gauteng, is so fraught with incompetence, maladministration, corruption, and Tabisa Hospital is probably the epicenter of that corruption, which saw the whistleblower and financial manager of Tembisa assassinated to keep the issue quiet. And I don't know, I haven't seen much happen. One accused, suspended CEO, I think, has died. Where the disciplinary processes have gone, let alone the criminal processes have gone, God alone only knows. And this comes hard on the heels of the improper appointment to the CETA boards by the now fired, resigned, whatever, Minister of Higher Education. So this is what you need to know about these young leaders becoming board members of Gauteng hospitals. They're to be paid an estimated amount of 10,000 rand for each meeting they attend. Probably because of a lack of experience, let alone a lack of understanding of what their roles would involve, they've launched onto social media to celebrate their appointments to the board. And you just get a sense of it where one successful candidate, whose name goes by the name of Ziyanda Nkuru, is a Youth League deputy secretary who is listed as a volunteer at Lithuli House. And said Ziyanda has boasted about the Young Lions having received their shares. Now, you know, the kind question to ask is whether these young leaders have anything to offer in the way of expertise in law, finance, management, governance, medicine, or any health-related background. That is unknown. But the appointees include, with no reference to whether they have any benefit to the health sector other than earning salary, I think we can probably assume they are of no benefit whatsoever.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
A lovely good news story for Sorogon Rogue is the fact that the under 20 South African rugby team has won the under 20 World Cup, and their final outing was against giants even at the under 20 level, and that was New Zealand. It shows more than anything that rugby really appears to have got its act together, that it's been dealt with creatively, shall we say the least, with the adult team, for want of a better word, through the coaching of Rassie Erasmus and his team. But it looks like it has really gone into the young teams, the young players who will be the key to future Bok teams, and they have done us proud in this regard. One doesn't get quite the same sense of success from other teams in other disciplines. Cricket always seems to just not really quite get its act together, notwithstanding that they did that the South African cricket team did us proud in winning the Test series against favourites Australia a few weeks ago. The South African women's soccer team has essentially come up from behind and won and scored a win against, I think it was Ghana, if I remember correctly. Sorry, I'm just so sort of sported out. But there is a sign that the sort of organisation skills and imagination that is being applied in the sporting arena, if only it could be applied to the broader sense in general, to the broader political environment. So be that as it may, good luck and well done. And I think our ladies' netball is making strides. So on the sport, if the sporting front could represents what we could be economically, we are in really, really good shape. And so finally, I just wonder whether anyone noticed the extent to which suddenly our potholes are being repaired on roads in Joburg. I don't know how extensive it is, but in my neck of the woods, suddenly potholes and even whole stretches of road are being repaired. And whether it's being repaired by the municipality or by the private sector parties such as Discovery, I honestly don't know, but it is truly a wondrous thing. However, my response to it is one of, well, you know, a job is finally being done and there is so much to be done that it still leaves the local government elections next year, towards the end of 2026 or early 2027, up in the air. So we still have much to wait for, to see what will affect our choices in those government elections. And as we've seen many times in the past, and I keep saying, voting is crucially important. You need very few voters to ultimately make a difference. Everyone needs to vote. So watch out for pothole repairs. We aim to be pleasantly surprised, but don't get rid of your skepticism too soon. Keep that skepticism in place, but I will keep you informed on events political, and we'll be back next week to do so. Thank you for sitting with us on Sorogon Rogue. Goodbye.